With that, let's open our Bibles back to Daniel chapter 7. We'll continue our study of the book of Daniel. We are in what's known as the apocalyptic section, the futuristic section, the eschatological section. And it is going to be a thrilling study over the coming months to see how God unfolds for us what's going to happen in the future. And he doesn't hide it. The title for today is The Ancient of Days and His Opened Books. We're going to begin our study in verse 9, but let's pick up the context from what we looked at the last couple weeks in verses 1 to 8. Daniel has a dream. He says, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and the visions in his mind as he lay on his bed. And he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it. Daniel said, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had the wings of an eagle. I kept looking until its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind also was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one resembling a bear. And it was raised up on one side, and 3 ribs were in its mouth between its teeth. And thus they said to it, arise, devour much meat. After this, I kept looking, and behold, another one like a leopard, which had on its back 4 wings of a bird. The beast also had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. After this, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying, and extremely strong, and it had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. While I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them, and 3 of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth uttering great boasts. We looked at that in the last 2 weeks. Now we come to the next scene, verse 9. I kept looking until thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His vesture was like white snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames. Its wheels were burning fire. A river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending him, and myriads upon myriads were standing before him. The court sat, and the books were opened. Then I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. I think it's way too often that curiosities and desires about God and desires from God can be misplaced. Let me explain what I mean. We desire guidance from God more than we desire God as our guide. We desire counsel from God sometimes more than we seek the wonderful counselor. We desire blessings and gifts from God more than God as the giver of these graces, and we can easily desire justice from God instead of resting in Him as the righteous judge. Another way of thinking about that is to think of what we want from God contrasted with wanting God Himself. Let's remember the context in which Daniel is writing. The southern kingdom of Israel, Judah, has been taken into captivity. It's a judgment against their sin of neglecting God and compromising worship for him for worshiping idols. God gives Daniel a dream that outlines the rule of the world from Babylon to the kingdom of the Antichrist at the end of the age. This parallels a dream that he gave Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 2. It was illustrated by a giant statue of composite materials as it went from head to toe. This is, which is kind of a glorious examination of these kingdoms with valuable metals. This is different. This is monstrous. We read the word beast. Really, the word to translate that is as monsters. He has this dream of four monsters coming up out of a turbulent, storm-tossed sea. And they represent the rule of man from the kingdom and the empire of Babylon through the Medo-Persian Empire, through the Grecian Empire, to the Roman Empire, stage one, when the Messiah comes, and stage two, when the Messiah will return. Why is this so important to detail? Why all the detail? Well, it's important to remember the context. Daniel was writing this to encourage and inspire and give hope to people who were functionally in prison. They have been exiled. They've been taken away for some 60 plus years into captivity. They were tempted to believe that God lost. God had abandoned them. God had forgotten them. It was to encourage the people of God not to lose hope and to remember that God knows, God sees, God cares, even though it hardly looked like it. Here's the jewel to recognize. God does not merely give them the plan of history which would solve their curiosities and give them hope that Israel was going to be reestablished, that the Messiah was coming, that his kingdom would fill the earth. No. God shows them that, but he goes a step further. He actually, in the section we're going to be studying today, shows them that he is the ruler over history. He is orchestrating history. He alone gives hope, stability. Right in the middle of this dream, it's kind of odd because we just studied these first eight verses, the first where we were looking at the four monsters that came out of the sea. He describes them, what he saw. And then before we get the interpretation of that dream, there's an interlude. There's an important reminder in the midst of this as we study eschatology. He refers in this interlude to himself and to his son. As we study eschatology over the coming months, our goal is not going to be to study and to interpret news cycles and world events. It's not to create a bunch of eschatological charts. It's not to make rapture movies and rapture books. God's intention in unfolding the future before us, in unfolding the past that he has orchestrated, is that he is to be the center of focus. When we think about the future, we think about him, not just what's going to happen. This comes into crystal clear focus in this little interlude in the middle of Daniel chapter 7. Remember, Daniel has this dream. It's functionally a nightmare. It outlines the past empires that he's experienced and the coming empires that he hasn't even seen yet. And part of that dramatic dream includes this interlude. It's a theological relief. It's a deep breath. It's a pause from the shocking, terrorizing monsters that he sees coming up out of the sea to a calming influence of understanding that God is real, God is there, he hasn't forgotten, and he can be trusted. The camera, as it were, shifts from looking at these monsters, and he's going to look at the monsters again, down beginning in verse 15, to looking into heaven. It looks up. God shows Daniel himself in the middle of outlining world history. It's a dramatic contrast, by the way, from the Antichrist in verses 7 and 8, who is blasting arrogant blasphemies against God and against God's people and to God himself, to a shift now to the sovereign Lord, the judge of the nations. That God is, what God is like, and what God thinks. These are the most important perspectives a human can entertain in our minds. And that's exactly where Daniel's dream shifts in verse 9. This is so instructive. In the middle of thinking about the past, the present, the future, the world histories that we see exploding on the what we're facing as World War III, as we hear on the nightly news, Daniel says, yeah, he's got all that covered. He wants you to turn and look at him. And if your eyes are only on the kingdoms of this world, you will be discouraged. And so were the people of God there in captivity in Babylon. But in the middle of this incredible dream, this freakish, monstrous nightmare, God says, don't forget me. Don't be distracted by what's going to happen. Be intent on thinking about who's making it happen. So last week we talked about the mesmerizing monsters of Daniel's dream. Today I want to give you four mesmerizing observations about the Ancient of Days. Now, why mesmerizing? Because 10 times in this passage, Daniel says, I kept looking. And really the meaning of that phrase was, I was mesmerized by what I saw. I was taken back. I was captivated. Well, here he's mesmerized by God, who is called the Ancient of Days in this section. Four mesmerizing observations about the Ancient of Days that God just lays out for Daniel to absorb into his own spiritual understanding. The first is in the first little section of verse 9. His interminable identity. I love that word, interminable. No term limit, no extent, no beginning, no end. There is no term to his identity. Daniel says, I was mesmerized. I kept looking, verse 9, until thrones were set up and the Ancient of Days took his seat. So remember what's happening. Daniel sees this dream of these four monsters coming up out of the sea. Three of them resembled animals that he could identify. The last one doesn't resemble any animal. It is monstrous. He can't even describe what it looks like. But he keeps looking. And the camera shifts from earth to heaven. And he sees the Ancient of Days taking his seat. Perhaps the most surprising part of this dream is the sinful, out-of-control disposition of that little horn that's boasting and blaspheming God and attacking believers in verses 7 and 8, contrasted with God and his disposition. Look at the heart, the attitude, the actions of this little horn, the Antichrist, down in verse 25. He will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Highest One. He will intend to make alterations in times and in law, and they will be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. He's an arrogant blasphemer of God. He's an arrogant blasphemer to God, and he is a harasser of God's people in his reign. Now, we're going to come back and talk about him later in the chapter. Daniel does. But contrast that view in verses 7 and 8 with the sovereign ruler and judge of the universe. He's shown sitting down comfortably on his throne, in absolute control, preparing for judgment, calm and collected, completely different than this little horn, the Antichrist. Now we meet God in his interminable identity. He's called the Ancient of Days. God is called the Ancient of Days only three times in the Bible, and all three of them are in this chapter. Verse 9, verse 13, and verse 22. So he's the Ancient of Days. What does that mean? Well, you got to be careful. Don't assign the idea that this is describing an old, senile, decrepit man diminished by age and his strength and his ability. God doesn't get weaker as he gets older, and he doesn't even get older. He's always eternal. Dale Ralph Davis says, this title for God then means that he is grand, not that he is frail. It imports ideas of dignity, not senility, end quote. Why the Ancient of Days? That's a strange Hebrewism and Aramaic phrase, Ancient of Days, which is the way a way to say he is ancient outside of days. He is beyond the past and beyond the future. He never had a past. He's always existed. He will never go out of existence. He doesn't have a future like we think of it. Now let's think about this for a minute, because this is a significant view of our God. This is God the Father, and we know that because he's going to present the kingdom to God the Son in the next paragraph. You remember back in Exodus 3, verse 14? This is where Moses goes up on Sinai, and he has this interaction with God in the burning bush. That's important. We'll come back to that in a minute. He has this interaction with God, and he asks God a strange question. He says, I'm going to go back to tell the people that you're going to deliver them, and they're going to ask me, what's your name? It's unexpected. They're going to want to know what your name is. That's because all the Egyptian gods had a name. God says, okay, I'll tell you my name. I am. Moses says, I don't think you understand. They're going to need a name for you. He says, okay, I'll be more specific. I am that I am. The eternal present tense being. He's the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. This is significant for Daniel and the exiles. Why do they need to know this? Why should they understand this? Well, thinking of God's eternality can almost seem unattainable for us unless we know what it means to us in the moment. We have a God who has directed, seen, and knows everything in the past. He's with us in the present. He knows and unfolds and orchestrates the future. That's helpful if we're in a difficult time. So let's talk for just a minute. Let's kind of push pause and talk about the Ancient of Days, the ancient beyond days, the ancient outside of days, the ancient who's not bound by days, the ancient God. A.W. Pink writes about this. I'm going to be honest with you. Of all of God's attributes, this one does the most to mess with my mind. This one does the most to melt my understanding. This is the one that does the most for me to say, you are God and I am not. Because when you attach his holiness, his providence, his sovereignty to his eternality, it changes everything. Pink writes, A.W. Pink, there was a time, if time could be called, it could be called, when God, in the unity of his nature, though subsisting equally in three divine persons, dwelt all alone. In the beginning, God. There was no heaven where his glory is now particularly manifested. There was no earth to engage his attention. There were no angels to hymn his praises. No universe to be upheld by the word of his power. There was nothing, no one but God. And that not for a day, not for a year, not for an age, but from everlasting, from eternity. During a past eternity, Pink continues, God was alone, self-contained, self-sufficient, self-satisfied, in need of nothing. Had a universe, had angels, had human beings been necessary to him in any way, they also had been called into existence from all eternity. The creating of them, when he did, added nothing to God essentially. He changes not, Malachi 3:6 says. Therefore, his essential glory can neither be augmented nor diminished, end quote. So just Can we have a meltdown just for a minute together? I mean, thinking about God being eternal from now, going and never stopping, that kind of makes sense. That's you and me as well. We're never going to stop existing. But backwards. That he has always, always, always been. Before there was a universe, he was. Forever backwards. Double negative. He never didn't exist. He had no beginning. He has always been. This is captured in the idea of he's ancient of days. He's outside of days. He's over days. He is not constrained or confined by days. He's the ancient of days. God's eternality should serve our souls as an immeasurable comfort. Think about this. He has seen everything from beginning to end. He has never said, uh-oh, or whoops. He's seen the whole course of history that is behind us. He sees the very present, and he knows everything that's going to happen. He orchestrates it. He is at every point in time right now from beginning to end. We said this a few weeks ago. He is right now at your birth and your death. Right now. Psalm 139 says, you have numbered, you know exactly the number of every one of my days. He knows the day of your death just as well as he knew the day of your birth. He knows how your life turns out. He knows how your life ends up. He knows what happens in every governmental structure, in every local war and world war. He is never out of control. He always knows because he is outside and engaged with time in a way that I could never, if I had 1,000 sermons, come close to explaining. So no trial should be engaged with without this reality in mind. God is there. God knows. He sees. He cares. Shift your eyes for a second. There are thrones. There are thrones there. He takes his seat on the thrones, but there are other people on the thrones until thrones, plural, were set up. We're going to see his throne in a minute. But what are these thrones? Well, we find the same symbolism in Revelation 20, verse 4. John says, I saw thrones, plural, and they sat on them, and judgment was given to them, and I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded because of their testimony of Jesus and because of the word of God, and those who had not worshiped the beast or his image and had not received the mark of their forehead, on their hand, they came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. They reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. That's sitting on a throne. And you say, whoa, that's kind of weird. Talking about people, believers, someday sitting on the throne with God at another throne. Say, I don't know that I can buy that. Well, let's listen to what Jesus said. Luke 22:30. Speaking to the disciples, that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom, and you will sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And you say, okay, that's just the 12 disciples. Okay, how about 1 Corinthians 6, verse 2? Do you not know that the saints will judge the world? If the world is judged by you, are you not competent to constitute the smallest law courts? Revelation 3:21, he who overcomes, Jesus says, I will grant him to sit down with me on my throne. I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne. You say, how does that work? I don't know. There are thrones in heaven by the throne of God, and he invites saints who have been redeemed to sit with him in judgment on the world. Paul affirms that. Jesus affirms that. John affirms that. Now, a quick note before next week. There's a sense in which this whole chapter should be one sermon, and a sense in which I'm not that good. Daniel sees both God the Father and God the Son in this interlude, in this vision. The Ancient of Days and the Son of Man. We'll come to the Son of Man next week. Did you realize that's exactly what John sees in Revelation 4 and 5? God the Father sitting on the throne, giving the title deed, the scroll, the ownership of the earth to the Lamb of God in chapter 5. And remember this, there are overlapping parallels in symbolism between members of the Godhead in apocalyptic literature. If you try to say this is only the Father, this is only the Son, this is only the Spirit, you're going to be really confused. You're going to tripped up. And we'll see that in just a minute, and we'll see it more next week. His interminable identity. He is forever. And he's on our side if you believe in him. What a grace. Secondly, his holy manifestation. His holy manifestation. This is what he was wearing. What he was wearing makes a big impact on Daniel. His vesture, literally his clothing, his array, was like white snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. So Daniel's gaze is mesmerized by the Ancient of Days, and as he looks at the Ancient of Days, he's struck by what he's wearing. He's struck by how he's clothed. Particularly, he says his clothes were white as snow. We've talked about this before in our study of Mark. There was no bleach in the ancient Near World. Pure white was not attainable by washing clothes well enough. However, the angels appeared to the women and the disciples after the resurrection in clothing that was noticeably white. Mary gets her announcement from someone who is dazzlingly white arrayed. And I love this. When Jesus is transfigured in the presence of Peter, James, and John, Mark makes this interesting comment about the Lord's clothes, and it verifies what we said about washing to whiteness and the inability to it. Mark 9:3, and his garments, this is Jesus transformed in front of them on the Mount of Transfiguration, Jesus' garments became radiant and exceedingly white, as no launderer on earth can whiten them. The point is, this is supernatural brilliance. The white here could not be generated by any kind of laundering. You say, well, how could they even describe that? The whitest thing they could see was, drumroll, snow. They would look up at Mount Horeb, and they would look and say, that's white. Those who had climbed up and seen snow, that is whiter than anything they had ever generated. And this was whiter than that. Now, this is the first day of snow. It's not the third day. We all know what that looks like in Kansas City after you drive on the snow for a few days. This is the first day of snow. The symbolism is about supernatural, absolute purity, unstainedness. And it extends to his hair, which is woolen, like a washed sheep. This is not pointing to his age as a gray-haired old man. It is his unrivaled moral perfection. By the way, as I said earlier, the symbolism, we got to be careful saying, well, that's the Father and that's the Son and nothing crosses over or relates to the other. Listen to what John sees when he sees the resurrected Lord Jesus Christ in Revelation chapter 1. See how familiar this sounds. John says about Jesus, his head and his hair were white like wool, like snow, and his eyes were like a flame of fire, which is what we see next about God. John Walford is helpful here. He says that Christ, as the Son of Man, should have a similar glory to the Ancient of Days is no contradiction, as their glory is the same, even though their persons are distinguished here in Daniel 7. I would also say in Revelation 4 and 5. He was morally pure, perfect, beyond anything that could be generated from this earth up, laundering. He was brilliant in his moral perfection, which gives him the right to judge sin. More on that next week. The third mesmerizing observation about the Ancient of Days, his interminable identity, his holy manifestation, and number three, his righteous justice. This is really the point of what he looks up to see as God shows him a vision of himself. Last phrase in verse 9, his throne was ablaze with flames. Its wheels were a burning fire. A river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending him, and myriads upon myriads were standing before him. And the court sat, and the books were opened. Now Daniel's attention is drawn to the throne on which the Ancient of Days sits in this holy moral array. He says it was ablaze with flames, literally flaming with fire, roaring. And then it says its wheels were all ablaze, literally its wheels were blazing fire themselves. These were tires of fire. The scene is overwhelming to Daniel. He'd never seen anything like this, and neither have you. The throne room of God is en fuego. It is on fire. Why? Because fire is a common symbol of judgment in God's word. And the fact that his throne is engulfed in flames pictures that he is on his throne of judgment. Now, what are these wheels? What kind of throne has wheels? A chariot. A chariot, when a king sat in a chariot, was considered his portable throne. This is a throne that is also a chariot. What is that doing? Well, it's interesting because when you see this, and it's long, I don't have time to read it now. The vision of God that Ezekiel has in Ezekiel chapter 1, he talks about these wheels of fire, perfectly in keeping with this. And Stephen Miller comments, it was common in the ancient Near East for thrones of kings and gods to have wheels. These were chariots that they would move around in. Why? Why is it on wheels? Why does it have wheels? Well, the symbolism is that God's judgment is portable. It's portable. It can visit any place that needs judgment. It's able to move and find out sin and sinners and sinful nations. And notice that God is sitting on not only the throne, but there's a river of fire flowing from him. That's the river of judgment. It's flowing out of him. This lava, burning fire flowing from his throne. The source is the throne. The source is God. And it's describing judgment. Now, fire is often found where the presence of God was manifest. Exodus 3:2, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the midst of a bush. That's the burning bush. Exodus 13:21, the Lord was going before them in a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. Exodus 19:18, now Mount Sinai was all in smoke. The Lord descended upon it, and its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked violently. Fire is often associated with God's presence, but this is something else. This is God's judgment. Leviticus 10:1, Now Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took their respective fire pans and putting fire in them, placed incense on it and offered strange fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. And fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. Numbers 11, verse 1. Now the people became like those who complain of adversity in the hearing of the Lord. And when the Lord heard of it, his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp. And the people cried out to Moses and prayed to the Lord, and the fire died out. Numbers 16:35. Fire also came forth from the Lord and consumed the 250 men who were offering the incense. And probably summarizing all of that is a passage you've probably already thought about, and that's Hebrews chapter 11, verse 29. For our God is what? A consuming fire. Fires destroy. Fires consume. That's a picture of God consuming and destroying in judgment. Now, before we leave this scene, two more features about God are described by Daniel here. First, it's those who are accompanying him. It's a countless number of beings, thousands upon thousands, myriads upon myriads. Those are the biggest numbers he can find. Countless. It's as close to him saying infinity. I looked and people were going forever, standing before him, sitting on these thrones. Daniel empties his vocabulary trying to say something like a countless number, an infinity of hosts. Now, lots of debate about these beings. Are these angels or are these saints and people? And the answer is, if you read Daniel 7 and the whole book of Revelation, is yes, all of the above. They're with him. All why? Why are they there? Affirming that he has the prerogative of justice and God making himself accountable to them to say, look at what I'm doing and why I'm doing it, to show that he is justified in judgment. There's a second feature here. It said the court sat and the books were open. That's an English way to say the books were open. Literally, the scroll was rolled out. He rolled out a scroll. Not one, multiple scrolls. Why are there multiple scrolls? The scrolls were rolled out. Well, these were records that account for the judgment that God is meting out. Now, I want you to understand this because we're going to come back to this many times in the next year or two that we spend in Daniel and Revelation. In Daniel 7, these are the records of the nations. In Revelation chapter 20, verse 12, they're the records of individuals. But they're all accounted for. Just for a minute, you can look with me or you can just listen. But in Psalm 2, verse 1, why are the nations in an uproar and the people devising a vain thing? The kings of the earth take their stand and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. It's exactly what Daniel talks about, saying, let us tear their fetters apart and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens, sitting on his throne, he laughs. He scoffs at them. The Lord scoffs at them. Then he will speak to them in his righteous anger and terrify them in his fury, saying, but as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. That's next week. Matthew 25, there's the judgment of the sheep and the goat nations. Some of these scrolls, in other words, are God looking at the nations and making judgments about entire empires. But there are other scrolls too. Revelation 12, verse 12. John says, I saw the dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne, and the books were opened. The scrolls were rolled out. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged from the things which were written in the books, plural, according to their deeds. Judgment by God is always by his books, by his scrolls. You know why? God is keeping a record of everything that happens in this world. Every nation and every person. He's keeping an account. He's taking notes. Isaiah 35:4, say to those with an anxious heart, take courage, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance, and he will then recompense. He will save you. He will reward according to what? The scrolls. Isaiah 40, verse 10, behold, the Lord will come with might, his arm ruling for him. Behold, his reward is with him and his recompense before him. He has looked at his scrolls. He has looked at his lists, and he knows what to do with the judgment of the nations and with the judgment of you and me. All of this recompensing is based on God's recorded history of each nation and of each person. Think about this. God's omniscience is recording everything in your entire existence. Every action, every word, every thought, every intention, God captures it all. Psalm 139, verse 1. Oh Lord, you have searched me and know me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up, you understand my thought from afar. You scrutinize my path and my lying down and are intimately acquainted with all my ways. That's individually. He also keeps notes on the nations. Who's promoting his values, his righteousness? But God's knowledge of our entire being is not just a threat for judgment. It's comforting for those who know him. Psalm 139, verse 23, search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts. Help me. See if there's any hurtful, literally painful way in me, and lead me in the everlasting way. Help me with what you know of me. God will make all things right. But he'll do it in his way, and he'll do it in his time, not ours. Number four, just touching on this, because there's going to be a full explanation at the end of the chapter on this, his victorious dominion. He's going to hand that to the Son in the next paragraph. Then I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. This is the Antichrist that we've already seen. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire, the burning fire, not any burning fire, the fire that's burning, that's flowing from that river from the throne. He judges himself. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. They had their season, but it didn't last forever. And again, we'll be coming back to this judgment of the final world empire, the fourth beast of the Antichrist in the last part of Daniel. But for now, remember that this is a parallel to Revelation 19, verse 20. Listen to this. The beast was seized, and with him the false prophet who performed the signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. And these two were thrown alive into the lake of fire, which burns with brimstone. That is God's fire of judgment. What's going on here? God is letting Daniel know in this vision that the obliteration of the fourth beast will come in the future, and it will be associated with the second coming of the Son of Man. That's coming in the next 2 weeks. Each empire has and will have an appointed time to rule God's world, but each empire has an allotted time. They all die, and we'll learn next week that the Son of Man's kingdom lasts forever with no challengers. Each empire's time is fixed by God. Their time at the top doesn't stay at the top. Dr. Welvard says, when Medo-Persia followed Babylon, the dominion of Babylon was taken away, but in some senses, the lives of the participants were prolonged. The same is true when Greece succeeded Medo-Persia and when Rome succeeded Greece. But the end of the fourth beast will be dramatic, cataclysmic, and final. Both the rulers and the people involved are to be destroyed. And this interpretation agrees with Revelation 19. We just read that, verses 19 and 20, which records the beast as destroyed and its ruler cast in the lake of fire at the second coming of Christ. This is confirmed in Matthew chapter 25 and the judgment of the nations at the return of Christ. So put a placeholder there in your mind, but the last half of the chapter, the last third of the chapter really describes those two verses in great detail, and we'll be coming back to that. So what do we do with this? Can I give you just a couple of takeaways that I pushed back from my desk and said, what can I do to apply this in my own life and love for the Lord? Here are some takeaway thoughts. I have three. You can have more or less. Number one, God is just and the judge. God is just and the judge. In other words, he can be trusted to make all things right in his time and in his way, but we can't rush that and we can't demand it to be on our timetable. Remember what Abraham said in Genesis 18:25? Shall not the judge of all the earth deal, judge, justly? He's going to make all things right in his way and in his time. Number two, God's eternality should remedy our anxieties about the past, present, and future. God's eternality, his Ancient of Days-ness, God's eternality should remedy our anxieties about the past, the present, and the future. We need to remember that he knows the ending of all things because he's already written it. He knows us, he sees us, he cares for us. Consequently, anger, fear, anxiety, heartache can be parked with an eternal God. We have no need to fear the future because God is there and he's orchestrating it. We have no fear to be controlled by our guilt in the past because God has washed that if we've given him our faith and trust. And we can walk with him in our present because he is Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end, from all eternity to everlasting in his dominion. But I think the key here for us as believers is to dial into this third takeaway. Number three, the books of our lives are being written each day. Our scrolls are being written. You are writing your scroll right now. The books of our lives are being written each day with every decision we make. Here's the good news. You got a bad scroll. Your scroll is full of right and righteous accusations against what you've thought, what you've said, what you've done. But in Colossians 2, God takes the certificate of our debt, what we owe him, our scroll, and he nails it to the cross. Now that's a metaphor. Because what was nailed to the cross? Jesus was nailed to the cross. How do we square that circle? He made, 2 Corinthians 5:21, God made him who knew no sin to be sin on our behalf, that we would become the righteousness of God in him. He became our scrolls. The books that could be opened to condemn us became the Lord Jesus when he died on the cross for the sins of those who would believe. He died for them. What a good news. What a grace. So when I hear these scrolls and that I have a scroll and I have a book that's written that God will open it up, I'll see that one day. It terrifies me. Until you realize that he took our certificate of debt, our scroll, our book, our condemnation, and he nailed it to the cross, not with a piece of paper and a scroll, but in his son himself, who became for us sin, that will be judged by the righteous Father. Have you put your faith and trust in him? Can I give you just some strikingly good news? If you try to live your life trying to make a scroll that Jesus will open up and say, oh, they made it into heaven, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. Nobody has that book written. But if you live your life knowing that he crucified that certificate of debt, that scroll against you, the book that was written against you on the cross, and you know what he did in the place of that? Revelation 19, he wrote your name in the book of life to live forever with him. Do you understand why the gospel is good news? It's the best news. My sin, oh, the bliss of this glorious thought, my sin, not in part, but the whole, is what? Nailed to the cross, say it with me, and I bear it no more. Praise the Lord, oh my soul.